This is the Chad Whittle Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to the Chad Whittle Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Chad Whittle. My guest is currently a reporter at KTRK ABC 13 in Houston. Jeff Ealing joins me now. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Chad. Glad to be here. How are you doing?
I am great. I'm excited about the premiere episode of the podcast, and I really appreciate you coming on today.
No problem.
So you began your reporting career in 1986. So about
a long time ago.
A long time ago. Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's my favorite year in the 80s, because that's the year I was born, 86. So not trying to make
you, a little bit, doesn't it?
I'm not trying to make you feel old.
No, not at all.
Hey, listen, time flies. Okay. I'm 33. Yeah. I look back. I don't know what happened to my 20s.
They're a haze for me as well.
I feel old sometimes when I'm in class. I have a pop culture references from the early 2000s or the 90s, and my students are like, yeah, we don't know what that is.
Yeah, right. You're from Mars at that point.
Oh, that's right. You don't remember 1994, 97.
That's right.
You weren't there. You weren't there.
That's right.
Yes. We had something called MySpace and AOL Instant Messenger, stuff they've never heard of.
Yes. No, what's that anymore?
I believe they actually shut it down. I don't believe it exists anymore.
Yeah, I think they did.
It kind of made me sad in a way, because I remember as a teenager talking to friends on there and MSN Messenger as well. And
right.
Time flies. It really does.
It really does.
So 33 years you've been a reporter.
Yep.
Long time.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. Yeah, you know, when I started out in 86, I was in Valdosta, and I was still going to school at the time. I got very lucky in that I was taking classes for television and radio production, and I met some people who were employed at the local TV station there, Channel 44. And, you know, after a couple of months of working within the school system, you know, with the BSU television and Blazer TV, a couple of people who I knew who worked in, you know, in an actual television station asked me if I want to come to work. And I thought, well, yeah, that's why I'm going to school, of course. So I ended up starting there basically as somebody who would load up a news vehicle with water and take it to the transmitter site and make sure that the transmitter didn't get too hot and would trip its circuit and the TV station would be off the air. You had to use distilled water in it, you know. So I did that, and I swept the floors of the transmitter, and basically I had one monitor that watched, that was always tuned to Channel 44. So whatever was on Channel 44 is all I got to watch. But I got a lot of studying done, and, you know, I got to watch some Monday Night Football occasionally. So it wasn't too bad.
But that's so great that while you were in college, you already had your foot in the door. You already could put that on your resume. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, and it's something that I would,
the game.
Right. And you know, now it's a little bit different now. You know, they're not going to hire, typically TV stations aren't going to hire 17, 18-year-olds for, you know, full-time and part-time jobs in the newsroom and that kind of stuff. But, you know, internships, as you know, are widely available in just about every market, just about every TV station. And I would encourage anybody who is in college, if they're thinking about getting into the business, or if you're just interested in seeing what the business is about, apply for an internship somewhere and work at a television station and see what it's all about. My station actually has moved to paid internships. It's not a lot of money, but, you know, it's better than getting nothing. So it's certainly an avenue that still exists, and I would take full advantage of it. My own son is thinking about going into journalism against my wishes, I might add. But I told him, hey, look, you know, if you get into college and, you know, you want to explore TV, the way to do it is to do internships. You can't beat the experience. And obviously working kind of trumped that a little bit. But man, it was a great time. It really was. It was fun.
So let's go back to the early days of your reporting career.
All right.
What do you remember about that time?
Well, the thing that's changed so much, you know, at the time, you know, you really could be you could have a specialized job. You know, the photographers would shoot video. The editors would edit the video. Some stations, not mine, but some stations back then still had sound guys that would you know, take care of the audio if you were out on a shoot. And the reporter just reported that, and that was pretty much everything you could do. So you could have four people working on one story. And as the gear was sort of the reason why, you know, the camera was very heavy. The record deck was very heavy. It was, you know, cumbersome to try to do all of that and have the boom mic. And of course the reporter was concentrating on getting the information. So it was very, very difficult for one person to do it all, or sometimes even two people to do it all. So the machines were very heavy. The batteries didn't last very long. We used these great big 3/4-inch video tapes to record our video on. And, you know, the actual machines that we edited on had moving parts, something you don't see anymore. You know, you put the tape in and the machine, kind of like a VCR, you know, you understand how VCRs work. I don't know if some of your audience members do, or any of your students do, but there's actually moving parts in there. You know, there's belts and tap stands and all that. So, you know, the machines were so much bigger and so much heavier and really way, way more limited than what we have today as far as sound quality, as far as video quality, and, you know, you can use a very low lights now. Back then, you had to have a giant light kit everywhere you went. You know, you really were carrying around like 200 pounds of gear, it seemed like. You know, it was difficult for one person to do it. It was difficult for a person to carry all that stuff, quite frankly.
Now, a lot of stations in smaller, mid-sized markets, they have the one-man band where the reporter writes, edits, shoots.
That's right. That's right. In fact, not just in small and medium sized markets, but even in Houston, where I work now, some stations are hiring one man bands. They call them multimedia journalists now, and they're responsible for doing every single thing. In fact, some of the people who have been recently hired at my television station are multimedia journalists, and you know, on certain days they go out completely by themselves now. And there's no more editing machines anyway. It's all computerized. You know, so you can have a laptop. And your camera records the audio, so there's no, you know, there's no worrying about that. And then there's no record deck anymore because you don't have tapes. You just have like a P2 card or, you know, a data card. You just put that in there. So, you know, the tools of the trade have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller and more compact. And honestly, I don't really see it stopping anytime soon. You know, there are people who can use their iPhone and get everything they need from an iPhone, which is maybe a microphone extension, you know, and that's it. So it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller and easier and easier and easier for a single person to sort of do it all. And really, if you're specialized now, you're kind of a dinosaur. You know, they don't want photographers to just shoot. They want them to be able to edit. And if they have to, voice a track if they needed to. And the same thing with reporters. Obviously, if you're getting hired as a multimedia journalist or a one man band, as we used to call it, then you got to do it all. And fortunately, it's a little bit easier to do it all. I mean, it's all computer based now. So, you know, if a machine has dirty heads, you know, you're if you don't know how to clean the heads, you're done. Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore because now there's no more tape. It's just you put the card in, you put the disc in, 11 as you're ingesting it in a large system, and everybody in the TV station can see the video as soon as you get back.
Yeah, let's talk about ABC 13's digital digital strategy. Obviously, you have a website and an app, but how much time are they putting into the digital side? Producing videos for Facebook, maybe live streaming the broadcast. Right. Are they concentrating heavily on that end?
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of the issue right now, a lot of especially television stations are having, is figuring out how to monetize that stuff. You know, how do you make money off of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and that sort of thing? And some are, I guess, doing it a little bit, but we really do push very hard to try to get as much content as we can on Facebook and Twitter and we're doing YouTube newscasts, and you know, obviously with our website, we're streaming the newscasts. We'll even stream, you know, press conferences with the mayor or you know, big news events or you know, traffic accidents or any kind of stories that we're on. We're always we're always on guard to sort of stream the, you know, to put that up and make it available on the web. So you know, you ask what kind of commitment we have. Well, when I first started, there was no World Wide Web, so there was no internet department, you know. But now we have a web department that has a web senior manager and a web producer and you know, web associate producer and that kind of stuff. So you know, it's really a focal point for a lot of what we do now because you know, so many people are just using that as the way to get their news and to get their information. So even if you're not making money on the internet, it doesn't really matter. If that's where the eyeballs are, that's where you got to be. And we have, I don't know, probably, I'm going to guess maybe 15 web only people who are working, you know, 8-hour shifts around the clock, Monday through Sunday. You know, there's always somebody in the web. Whereas when I first started, you know, like I said, there was no World Wide Web. So that's a huge difference from back in 1986.
Yeah, let's go back to the late 80s, early 90s, the beginning of the World Wide Web, and maybe the mid 90s. The newsrooms you worked at, what was their reaction? Did they then take the internet, the web, seriously as a competitor, as a compliment, just a fad? What was the thinking back then?
I don't think anybody saw it in television as a competitor. And I don't really think we look at it necessarily as a competitor now, although in some cases we should. But a lot of times that we kind of felt like it was a competitor to the newspaper, because the web back then was just printed, you know, just typed material. There really was very little video, and maybe you'd get some pictures, but most of it required you to read and absorb the content. Well, television stations were never, you know, publishing their content on the web or in a written form that anybody could just walk up and take a copy of. You know, we write for broadcast, and you know, it's a couple of pages long and that's it, right? So nobody, I don't think anybody thought that we would be where we are today on the web. Certainly not, you know, with the advent of Facebook and Twitter and social media. You know, I don't think anybody saw that coming. But as far as embracing it goes, I don't think a lot of stations were forward thinking enough to get in on it, you know, at the beginning of the World Wide Web. Not that it really matters now, because it's, you know, anybody can get in. And in our station, I think we were one of the last few to get a dedicated website, but our website dominates the market. So it doesn't matter that you weren't necessarily first into the space. But you know, when I used it first off was in West Palm Beach. You got to remember, we had to transition from, like, the very first couple of stations that I worked at, there were no computers at all in the newsroom. Not one, not a single computer. I don't think anywhere in the building. We were all using typewriters, right? Well, you know, obviously there are no more typewriters in any building, any newsroom I've ever seen in the last, well, I've been at this for 20 years. There's certainly not any typewriters at Channel 13. I don't know where I would find one right now. And the funny thing is, I don't know if anybody would know how to use it either, you know? So computerizing the newsroom was a big, big deal. And I think that was something that was definitely embraced by a lot of different television stations. You know, you went from a prompter that needed paper to one that was just screen in front of the camera without any paper. You just computer, you know, loaded up on the computer. And that was a huge deal for television stations as far as the technological gain and how they could use computers. And then the web space specifically, you know, a lot of it was dominated by early on by, like, weather. You know, you could put weather up, that was fairly easy. And, you know, sports, you could have some. We used to joke around that we would have to quote unquote Weberize our television script. In other words, make it look like it was written for, you know, for the eye rather than for the ear. You know, so we had to go in and put quotes in, and, you know, James said blah blah blah. You know, make it look like more like a newspaper copy. That was something we were doing very early, you know, pretty early on, and when our station started getting the website. So I'd say most stations saw it as a tool, not necessarily as a content provider. But once it started becoming a content provider, things radically changed as far as how our television station, and certainly in the Houston area, how they embraced putting content on the web.
And social media. How has Facebook, Twitter changed how you gather news? Do you go to that to find stories, or you just use it to promote stories?
A little bit of everything, actually. So when about, I guess, 8 to 10 years ago, I was the consumer reporter at Channel 13, and the station didn't really have much of a web presence. But my producer wanted to take advantage of the web to get our stuff in front of other people, and also to use it, the comments section, to try to find, you know, additional news stories and consumer stories. And it worked like a charm, and it was fantastic. We were getting all kinds of rave reviews internally and really within the industry for what we were doing, because we could track really, in for the first time, exactly what consumers wanted to see as far as the stories go. We knew within a few minutes or a few hours what was a hit and what was a miss. And so we would tailor make our next story on what we thought would would get the eyeballs on the web. And it worked very, very well. Things that we thought would go great didn't do well. We just said, well, we're not going to do those topics anymore. And then the ones that that did well, sometimes they surprised us that they did well. We would always put those sort of on the, you know, in the file that says revisit this in a year or something like that. You know, we knew, like, for instance, one of the big ones was unclaimed cash. You know, states just started getting into their own websites for, you know, you can go and you can put your name in to see if there's any money that's been left behind for you. And like, you know, maybe you change power providers or the security deposit or whatever is still available. Well, states were trying to get people to go on to their websites to get that, you know, so people could claim their money. And Texas was pretty good about, you know, making it very easy to do. Well, we started doing web stories on that, finding our own people. We'd just enter in people's names. Yeah, you know, we'd go in the phone book and start looking up people's names and finding money for them. We'd call them up and go, hey, you know, this, you can get money just by going to the web. So our website would then provide links and people would go to our website rather than go to the state of Texas, you know, website, because ours was easy to remember, abc13.com, pretty easy, rather than state.tex.funds.citizen. You know what I mean? It becomes very unwieldy for people to remember that kind of stuff. So we were putting our content on and we were looking at our content, how it was performing to the web and tailor making what we did based on that. And then the other part of it was we would look at the comments section and people would say, oh yeah, you should do a story on XYZ. And, you know, we would, okay, fine, let's try that out. And then sometimes we would be able to find people to talk to within our stories, consumers within our stories who commented on things, you know, like if there was a recall on a particular vehicle, you know, people would jump on our website and say, I've got that car. And then we would contact them and say, can we come and talk to you about it? Most of the time they would say yes. So we kind of used it in a lot of different ways.
So other than technology, what are some other changes that you've seen through the years working in the broadcast news big business?
A couple of big things is you got to be very, very quick about jumping on things and turning things, because the competition is very, very fierce, especially in a city like Houston. I think we have 4 English language stations, 2 Spanish language stations. And, you know, if you want to be out in front of something, you really, really got to be able to move very quickly. And sometimes big stations like ours, they just move at a very slow pace. They're too slow to recognize a big story when it comes down, or a building big story. It's not always the case. You know, certainly this would be, you know, I'm not trying to call Channel 13. Every station is like that, you know, but being able to recognize trends. In fact, one of the things that our web department does, they have a whole thing about, you know, what's trending and how can we localize it? How can we bring that to Houston, or what's trending in Houston, even, you know, going down into that. Those are huge changes. You know, we, you know, back when I first started, you know, the morning meeting consisted of 4 or 5 reporters, and they would say, well, what do you got? And they would expect us to have already read the newspaper and, you know, have already, you know, maybe gone out in the community and interacted with people to try to figure out what's, you know, what are big stories in the area. Where now, I mean, my goodness, you can go to, you know, neighborhood next door, or you could go, you don't have to pick up the newspaper. The newspaper comes to you every moment of the day, you know, if you got a subscription. So that's a big change, just how quickly things go from an idea to being on the news or in a format where people can see it on TV or even on the web.
So take me through a day in your life. What's your daily routine? What time do you have to arrive at the station?
Well, now I am a morning show reporter. So the morning show, and I started at Channel 13 as a morning show reporter. I've been a dayside reporter, a consumer reporter, a nightside reporter. And now I'm back to working mornings. So that means I have to get in very early. So I usually get to work around 3 o'clock in the morning, and I get off the news at noon. Our newscast ends right at noon. So that's when my day ends. Our first newscast is at 4:30 in the morning. I'm not always in the 4:30. Sometimes I am. It just depends on what the story is. And then would make an appearance at 5, and then at 6, or 4:30, 5:30, 6:30. And then we do a web newscast at 7. That's about a 10-minute web newscast. And then after that, we start putting things together for 11 a.m. Then we have an 11 a.m. newscast. And typically, I'm done once my story ends at 11, whether it be 11 or 11:30. And so I usually get home around noon or 12:30, somewhere around there. But, you know, having said that, if there's that's a typical day. An atypical day would be like if a hurricane hits town, or you know, there's a wildfires or something. You know, you could be there, 16 hours if that happens. That typically doesn't happen though.
Looking back on your career so far, what's that one story, that one thing that is maybe your favorite event or topic or issue that you've covered in your career?
Well, I got sent to the second Gulf War, and that was a pretty big deal. We were, it was just me and a photographer. We got sent by Channel 13 to go there. And so we were expected to basically, be war correspondents, and we did not embed with the Army or, the Marines or anything like that. We were sort of independent on our own. So we had to find our own stories, and we had to be on the air at 6 a.m., 11 a.m., 4 p.m., 5 p.m., 6 p.m., and 10 p.m. Houston time. Well, Kuwait and Iraq are, about 9 hours difference, 10 hours difference. So, while everybody at 10 o'clock at night, when I signed off, it was 7 o'clock in the morning over there, and we would just have to start and do our day again. So, we worked basically, 20-hour days with two-hour breaks shoved in there somewhere. And that was crazy enough, just the hours and the things that we saw and all that. But then in that time, we were mostly in Kuwait, but the missiles that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi army were firing at Kuwait City were kind of coming towards where we were. And so pretty much every day, the first couple of weeks, there was a missile alert multiple times a day where we'd have to go down to the bunker, put on the gas mask, or if we were lucky enough to be in a building. If not, then we sort of had to kind of eyeball it, like, where do you think this thing might hit, and try to minimize any kind of damage that we would take. And then as the war started, we were able to get into a convoy of food relief for the people who lived in southern Iraq, who had been sort of cut off. The Iraqi military wasn't around there because the United States forces were in Kuwait and they didn't want to get overrun. So these people didn't really have much as far as food goes. And so the American Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society, which is like the Red Cross in the Islamic world, and the army, they organized a very large food relief convoy that went in to Safwan, Iraq, which is just sort of over the border with Kuwait. And while we were there, you can imagine people who were hungry are also kind of desperate, right? So, they open the back of the food relief truck and they start distributing these goods. And, it just becomes sort of a free for all, where people are just sort of grabbing. And as I'm covering that part of it, and, I looked underneath the 18-wheeler, and there was this maybe, 6-year-old boy. And he was waiting for things to drop down, that were falling out of boxes and stuff. And he was sort of grabbing them and setting them aside. Imagine that, somebody who's so desperate to feed himself and his family that he's sort of picking up the scraps of what was left behind and trying to create a little hoard for himself, and that we were able to talk to that boy with the help of a translator. And we talked to the folks at the Army, and we talked to, the civilians who were, who were in desperate need. And I'll never forget that one, because that was a pretty interesting one. One of the things that when I got back, people said that they remember the most was that during the missile attacks, we were often on the air. Our little live spot was the roof of a hotel in basically downtown, a little bit off downtown Kuwait City. And so once the missile attack started, they just shut the door. So if you were outside, you're just outside, right? So there's no sense in really running, for cover. There's no cover to have. So we would be broadcasting, and all of a sudden the alarms would go off, and we would just sort of stay up there because there was no place for us to go. And when I got back, people were very, impressed is the right word, or I don't know exactly what the right word would be, but they were surprised that we stayed up there. And, people were saying how brave and stuff we were. The reality is there really wasn't any place for us to go, so we might as well just do it live on TV. So those were some of the stories that you don't forget. And then some of the good ones, very recently, the Houston Astros won the World Series. And because I work in the mornings now, I was asked to go to Los Angeles to do the morning show stories for Channel 13 during the World Series. So I got to go to LA and be at the World Series, watch these World Series games, and do the reporting on it for the morning show. And that was just a blast. You know, the Astros have been my home team, if you will, for the last, 19 years or so. And to see them, win the World Series, and how many times you get to see your team win the World Series, in game seven, it was fantastic. So that I'll never forget that, that was fun. And there's so many others too, like Hurricane Harvey hit here, and I've covered many, many hurricanes. Most of my career, if you plotted it out on the map, has been right around the Gulf or the Atlantic Ocean. So I've seen many, many storms and many, many hurricanes. But when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, it sort of stalled over the area, and we had so many areas and so many neighborhoods. In fact, the neighborhood that I live in flooded. My house did not. I was very fortunate, but I know so many people whose houses did flood. And at one point, I was at work, and we started going out on boats with volunteers who were going into people's houses and finding people who were stranded and couldn't get out, and putting them on boats and getting them to safety. And there was one day when I was doing that where we rounded a corner and there was this rushing bayou, and an older man and an older woman were on their back porch, and they had nowhere to go. There's nothing they could do. So we got close enough to get to them, I grabbed a life vest, sent out the boat, put one on him, put one on her, got them to the boat, and we got out of there. Right. So, in a very real sense, and I wasn't the only one doing that. I had a lot of colleagues that were doing that very same thing. So in a very real sense, we were out there saving people's lives. So that was incredible. Just incredible.
Yeah. That's something you're never going to forget. And stories like that really puts it into perspective that yes, it's a job, journalism is a job, but also you really can make a difference in people's lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. None greater, really, in my opinion, than the people who do like consumer reporting or the investigative reporting, because a lot of times people are desperate when they turn to, let's face it, a television news reporter for help. But I used to do stories with people who maybe signed up with a power company that wasn't necessarily legitimate. In Texas, they have deregulation. So instead of just one power company, you might have 15, right? Well, some of the least financially solvent of them would go out of business, leaving people without any electricity. So we had to, we'd advocate for them, try to get their money back and try to get them signed up for different things. So consumer reporting, I was very much, able to help help people out. And one of the things that I remember during the housing crisis that hit, back in was 2008 or 9, and people were literally losing their homes because they had taken mortgages that they couldn't pay. Most of them did no fault of their own. They were taking these adjustable rate mortgages that would balloon up their payments and stuff. But during that time, so many lenders went out of business, and other lenders were just taking over their inventory and sending out blanket notices that said you were going to have your home taken away from you because you didn't pay. Well, there were people who were caught up in that who paid every single month, or were told, hey, you can skip this month because we're changing lenders. Don't worry about it. The new lender gets in and says, oh, you're delinquent on your house. We're going to repo your house. So there were a lot of people who I helped navigate through that crazy, crazy time that had tried everything, and they were going to lose their house if they hadn't contacted somebody in the news who could try to advocate on their behalf. And I wasn't the only one doing it, but I just remember, the relief that these people had when they finally got, we got their story on TV, and you could find somebody at the new bank that would listen, and they would go, okay, yeah, right, this is an error. Don't worry, we're not going to repossess your home. I mean, you talk about, really helping somebody on a real personal level. That was it.
Yeah, that's great. Final question. Looking back at your career, if you could go back and give a young Jeff Ealing advice, knowing all you know now about broadcast television, what's that advice?
Almost kind of like what I said at the beginning, try to get a job, any old job at a television station if you really like it. That's what I did. Now, what advice would I give myself? Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that happened to me fairly early in my career, I was so young. I probably should have waited a little bit longer to start working full-time at a TV station. There's a lot of things I didn't know. Like, for instance, I'd never had a full-time job, a real full-time job before. So I didn't know that I could, had sick days. I could call in sick, right? Well, one day, I was working and I had the flu. I wasn't feeling well at all, but I went to work anyway, right? And I was just so tired that I fell asleep on my typewriter back when we had typewriters. And I remember my assistant news director waking me up and he said, "Hey, look, I know you're not feeling well. Just get in the news car, go shoot a VOSAD and bring it back and go home." Well, I loaded up the car, drove down the road, fell asleep behind the wheel, ran into an interstate bridge, and the car flipped over the bridge and went down into the ravine. I could have killed myself, right? I could have died. So if I could have said anything to me back then, it would be, don't go to work sick. And if you are sick, call in sick, for goodness sake, because it's not worth, it's not worth that kind of sacrifice. Trust me, it's not worth that kind of sacrifice. So that I would, take care of yourself and advocate for yourself. Because, news directors in all kinds of markets, especially the low ones, they've got so much stress that they're undertaking and that they're under that, sometimes they lose sight of the fact that we're human beings too. Not so much here in Houston, because, here we've got so many more people and there's the news day is going to get taken care of. But when you're down in a newsroom where there's maybe three reporters, you call in sick, there's two guys left or two gals left, right? So it's a big impact. But even if you are in a small station and you don't feel well, or you don't feel like you're in a safe area, advocate for yourself. Trust me, standing up for yourself is a good idea. And something else along those lines, when you get your first job, ask for more money. I know you don't want to. I know it's awkward. I know it sounds weird. But if they're offering you, I'm going to make up a number, say $20,000 to live in Beaumont, Texas, ask for 24. They've already decided to hire you if they've offered you a contract. And by asking for more money, you're probably going to give yourself at least a couple $1,000 raise. So don't feel intimidated talking to news directors about salaries. Trust me, they want to hire you if they've already offered you the job. You're not going to talk your way out of it. So advocate for yourself. Be a good advocate for yourself and learn as much as you can. Like I know how to run. One time I knew how to run pretty much every machine in TV. Now that we've gone to the computerized newsrooms, I know how to run a lot of the machines, but learn everything you can. If you like shooting, shoot. If you like editing, edit, but my goodness, learn to do both and learn to do both well. And if you want to be a reporter, watch the news, find somebody whose style you like on TV, really pay attention to how they're using the words, what they're doing with editing as far as their sound bites and that kind of stuff. Get a real good feel for how to do the job and start putting yourself a resume tape together early on and go for it.
And there you have it. My conversation with Jeff Ealing of KTRK ABC 13 Houston. Follow him on Twitter at Jeff Ealing ABC 13. Thank you for listening and please join me next time on the next edition of the Chad Whittle Podcast.
Subscribe to the Chad Whittle Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or listen at chadwhittle.com. The Chad Whittle Podcast with Chad Whittle. Copyright 2019. All rights reserved.